You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
A universe of Hollywood storytelling and intrigue awaits you now. Unlock the secret history of Hollywood by going to patreon.com/attaboysecret or follow the link in the show notes of this episode. Lena Basquette's plan was simple. Needing a fresh beginning, she packed up the small apartment that she and Ray Hallam had inhabited for such a brief time and moved in with her mother. The baby in her womb had not yet begun to add weight to her body, and she figured that if she was quick, she could find work in a stage show somewhere for a few months, put some money by to live on, and as the time approached when hiding the fact that she was with child became impossible, she could, in her own words, get lost somewhere and have my confinement without the glare of publicity. Life at her mother's house was cramped and loud and restless. Gladys, her mother, was part-time soothing angel and part-time judge of Lena's life so far. Why did Sam have to go and die? Maybe you drove him too hard. I was a kid. I wasn't driving anyone. Why did you think that having a baby with this terminally ill Hallam guy was a good idea? I didn't know I was having his baby until a week or so before he was gone. By then it was too late to tell him. I didn't want to break his heart anymore. When are you going to get some more money from the Warners?
I don't want their money, Mama. I can do this on my own.
Why don't you drink your milk? Why aren't you sleeping more? When are you going to find the next man to take care of you? How long do you think you'll be here? What's going on with Lita? Lena wished she knew what was going on with Lita.
The child growing inside her had reminded her of the first time this had happened and the golden life lived during those days.
Sam's hand on her stomach as they talked in bed. The long hours alone when she would read stories to the bump beneath her shirt. The curious sticky-haired thing that had slept so helplessly on her chest just a moment after Lena had forced her into the world. She remembered Lita's long fingers and the moment she'd opened her eyes for the first time to reveal two small black beads that gazed at her with 100 questions. She remembered the day that she dressed her daughter in her favorite white dress, made sure her socks were pulled up to the knees, perched her woolen beret at just the right angle, and then clutched her so tight that she thought she might break in her arms. She remembered holding her hand as they walked across the front lawn and met a man in a suit who helped Lita into Harry Warner's limousine and then took her small leather suitcase around to the trunk. Lena did not remember seeing Lita wave goodbye because her eyes had been closed tight until the sound of the car had faded away. How selfish that moment was, she told herself ever since. Al Jolson was in the midst of mounting a production of Wonder Bar, and on a whim, an offer was sent to Lena to join the supporting cast. The paycheck was more than generous, but the part required her to sing and dance. The singing was no problem, but the dancing was hampered by the growing stiffness in her hips and the needles of pain that were beginning to form in her legs. Rehearsals began, and for the first 2 weeks, Lena fought against morning sickness and monstrous fatigue through 14-hour days and uncomfortable rides home on cold, crowded buses. Somehow, the day of the show's opening arrived with Lena's role still intact. The nest egg, gently being feathered by Al Jolson's money, was looking more and more like the kind of money that could see a single mother through a winter, with perhaps a little extra. Her contract was for 10 weeks, by which time she estimated that the bulges around her middle and on her thighs were going to be too difficult to disguise to anyone with half a brain.
It'd also land her smack in the middle of October, when winter winds would begin to bite harder on those early mornings. That time of year, when all nesting creatures retreated into their pile of leaves to see out the winter with their young. It was on a Sunday, in the full bloom of August, that she decided to stretch her legs in the park and spent an afternoon walking around the zigzag paths and grabbing lunch at a nearby deli. It was as she was walking the dozen or so blocks back home that she was suddenly caught by a shooting pain that leapt through her legs and into her pelvis, forcing her to fall against the wall. She felt her arm being taken by strong hands and turned to see a police officer. "Are you all right, miss?" he asked.
"Yes, I think so. I watched you for a block. You were a little unsteady."
The small frown on his brow caused her to grin.
"Officer, if you think I'm tipsy, you're way off base. I'm in the family way."
"I couldn't think of using the word pregnant to a stranger," she said later. "Nice girls didn't say that in those days." "I'll get you a cab," the officer said. "In this heat, you should be home. Where's your husband?"
"I'm a widow," she said.
But as the words were leaving her mouth, she felt another bolt of pain kick through her and fell, screaming, to the sidewalk. "Miss! Miss!" cried the police officer. And then the sudden rushing of voices and noises and police whistles and hot and cold. The sensation of being lifted and placed on something soft. A woman's voice crying,
"Oh, sweet heavens, there's blood on the sidewalk!"
The next time her eyes opened, she was staring around a room so bare and functional that she knew she must be in a hospital. "Miss Basquiat," said a calm voice. She looked to her right and saw two men. "Don't strain yourself, Miss Basquiat," said the older of the two. "I'm Dr. Coleman and this is Dr. Golden. You just lie quiet. You've had a severe shock to your system." Lena tried to talk, but her throat was dry clay. The stabbing pain in her womb had transformed into a heavy ache, as though some indefinably heavy object was sitting on her. Instinctively, she lifted her arm and placed it on her stomach. "Oh God," she said. "Did I lose my baby?" The doctors looked at each other. "I'm so very sorry," said Dr. Coleman. Lena felt herself shudder, until the pain in her womb and in her legs and in every corner of her heart grew and grew, reaching up through her body like a root, like splintering glass, until finally she could bear it no longer and began to scream. As hands pressed against her, as a needle found its way into her arm, she felt herself descend into blackness, reaching for the last remaining part of Ray Hallam and losing it forever. In 1938, James Cagney made his grand return for Warner Brothers. The film he'd chosen was, of all things, a madcap comedy about two scheming Hollywood screenwriters trying to write a comic masterpiece while playing Cupid to a waitress and an English actor.
"Why did you make me run away? Why did the police chase me?
How many times do I have to tell you it's all part of the act?"
"It wasn't. It couldn't have been. I was the only one who was acting."
"Listen, young man, do you realize that I saved your life? Try registering gratitude."
Playing opposite Jimmy as his fellow screenwriter and partner in crime was Pat O'Brien, and as their boss, a harassed producer, Ralph Bellamy. As the unscrupulous agent of a cowboy star, Frank McHugh was cast, thereby turning the film into an on-screen reunion of sorts for the Boys Club. The film contained a number of well-judged in-jokes, including a scene at a glitzy premiere for a fictional movie, The White Raja, apparently starring Errol Flynn. The White Raja just so happened to be the name of a script penned by Errol Flynn himself in real life, and one that had been rejected by Jack L. Warner for being too weak and too dreary. When Flynn saw his work being mocked in the film, he was not best pleased. Boy Meets Girl was met with mixed reviews, some declaring it to be the farcical gem of the year, while others complained that the comedy fell a little flat. However, one thing that everyone seemed to agree upon was that James Cagney was back with a bang, and that Warner Movies hadn't been the same without him. What everyone really wanted, of course, was to see Cagney back in a gangster role, but Cagney had made it perfectly clear that he wasn't keen on playing a violent hoodlum, and even the Warner Brothers themselves had begun to view the traditional gangster movie as out of fashion by now. The buzz reached Jimmy himself, and while he initially dismissed the notion of playing a criminal as a backward step in his career, he was suddenly reminded of the crime-drama script he'd fallen in love with back at Grand National that was markedly different to the generic potboilers he was being presented with. After making a few calls and waiting for a few days, he received through the post a copy of the script, a drama about two childhood friends who, by chance, are thrust along very different paths in life. One becomes a holy reformer, dedicated to cleaning the streets of the criminal influence that threatens the neighborhood children, while the other allows himself to be corrupted by poverty and the dark side of the justice system until he becomes a crime lord, a violent folk hero idolized by American youth. In other words, one of the corrupting influences that his childhood friend has sworn to do away with. The script was Angels with Dirty Faces, and it was written by one of the most remarkable men in Hollywood's history. Roland Brown, born in 1900, was eager to fight in the First World War and tried to enlist at the age of 16. Because he was too young, he was turned away, but desperate to fight for his country, he enlisted again later, this time lying about his age. By the time he was called up to duty, the war was almost over. In fact, he'd been out of basic training for just 1 week when the final shots in the First Great War were fired. Disillusioned at not having proven himself, Brown took himself to New York and joined the ever-increasing band of men looking to make a living from prohibition by smuggling alcohol to the general public. It was while he was making a name for himself in crime that he crossed paths with Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, and instantly, the two men took a disliking to each other. Brown would constantly complain to his gang that Bugsy was nothing more than a blowhard, and Siegel himself called Brown a lumbering idiot. The war of words grew in intensity until finally, Siegel declared that Brown was a dead man walking.
He ain't got rhythm.
Brown responded to the open threat on his life by saying, "I'm just as tough as you are, Siegel, and I know your pals Frank Costello and Frank Nitti, and I've got a mind to call them and report what you've said." The fact that Bugsy Siegel backed down from his threat and took no further action demonstrates the considerable influence that Roland Brown must have held in the underworld. He was variously described by those who knew him as a big bear of a man, and put his large physique to good use by training at the local boxing gyms. It was during this period that he came into contact with current world heavyweight boxing champion Jack Dempsey, who was taking a break from title defenses, but who liked to keep his hand in at the training ring. Brown agreed to spar with Dempsey, and the two men got off to an amicable start. However, Brown's blood soon began to rise, and the punches between the two men became more and more ferocious. 5 minutes into the bout, Brown connected with a huge right hook and took the world champion off his feet. "He hung a right hand on my whiskers, and I felt sort of groggy and futile," said Dempsey later. "He gave me plenty and he took plenty." For years afterwards, Brown's claim to fame was that he had knocked Jack Dempsey down during a boxing match. However, he He tended to omit the fact that once Dempsey had climbed back to his feet, the tide had turned rather swiftly. Seeing that the gloves were off, so to speak, Dempsey dispensed with the dancing around and reminded the watching crowd why he was world champion by demolishing Roland Brown completely. Dempsey took the crowd out for beers, while Brown was sent to the nearest hospital, where he was laid up for almost 2 days. As the decade wore on, it was clear that the roar had gone from the 20s, and Brown took his experiences to Hollywood, where the crime genre was currently the hottest ticket in town. His story, Handful of Clouds, was turned into 1930's The Doorway to Hell, starring Lou Ayres and James Cagney. And so impressed were the watching executives that in 1931, they offered him the chance to direct another of his own stories, Quick Millions. This was followed in 1932 by Hell's Highway, a scorching expose of the chain gang system that acted as the perfect companion piece to I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, and in many ways, improved upon it. 1933's Blood Money came next, a cult favorite that even today is held up as a classic of the crime genre by such luminaries as Martin Scorsese. But even though his directorial career was in its infancy, he was beginning to develop a career as a hothead. Director and producer Alexander Korda was at the time endeavoring to improve the image of British cinema by importing international talent and adopting the best American techniques into British filmmaking. Spotting the talents of Roland Brown, he invited him over to England and offered him the chance to direct his lavish adaptation of The Scarlet Pimpernel, albeit with a difference. On the first day on set, Korda loudly advised Brown to direct the film as if it were a gangster picture. "I beg your pardon," said Brown, "but I'll direct the film the way I want to, or I'll walk." The cast and crew froze in horror and watched as Korda smiled sweetly, pointed to the door, and replied, "Please walk." Over the next few years, Brown's career as a director was overshadowed by his career as a walker. He walked out on David O. Selznick's What Price Hollywood when Selznick disagreed with Brown's rewrites of the script. He walked out on 1932's State's Attorney when his first choice of cameraman was denied. He walked out of The Yellow Ticket when he was told that Lionel Barrymore had been chosen as the lead. He walked out on Raffles because he was not allowed to add a contemporary element to the screenplay. Things finally came to a head in 1937, when Selznick took one last chance on Brown and hired him to direct A Star Is Born. Brown toiled away on the script and when he turned it in, was told by Selznick that it stank. Brown answered by giving Selznick the Jack Dempsey treatment, allowing his anger to get the better of him. He punched Selznick across the jaw, dropping the producer to the floor and all but finishing Brown's directorial career for good. But no one could deny that Roland Brown was a master when it came to storytelling, and for the next 2 decades, his twisted tales of the criminal element, all based on Brown's early experiences in crime, would permeate cinematic folklore and make for some truly memorable characters. This was never more evident than in 1938, when James Cagney rescued from the floundering Grand National Brown's script, Angels with Dirty Faces.
"Listen, Rocky, I've been worrying about this all last night. I can't let you take the whole blame.
Pipe down. You want that flapper to hear you? Now get this. You got it waiting, yeah?
Okay. Now why be a sucker?
Yeah, but it ain't fair to you, Rocky.
Now look, so they send me up.
So what?
What have I got to lose? But you, Rocky, supposing I was the one who got caught. I bet you wouldn't keep quiet.
Go on, what do you think I am? I'd lay dead just like you're gonna do. Always remember, don't be a sucker."
The film begins with two boys, William Rocky Sullivan and Jerry Connolly, who attempt to rob a railroad car containing fountain pens and who are chased down by the police. Jerry manages to escape, but Rocky is caught and sent to a juvenile detention facility. Over the course of the next decade, Jerry becomes a priest and pledges himself to the reform movement, doing the best he can to shepherd the children of his parish away from the glamorous world of organized crime. Rocky, on the other hand, is corrupted by his experiences at the juvenile halls. Blending with the criminal element brings out Rocky's darker tendencies, and it isn't long before he's risen through the ranks of New York's gangsters to become a fearsome enforcer and low-level boss. The two men reunite 13 years after the railroad incident, when Rocky is released from prison where he's been serving 3 years for armed robbery. His former gang, led by crooked attorney Jim Frazier, have promised Rocky his share of the holdup money, $100,000. But by the time Rocky is released, Frazier has used Rocky's cut to fund his rise to the top of the criminal ranks.
Where's that dough?
What, the 100 grand?
Yeah.
Might have had it for you, only as I said, I didn't expect
it. I know, you said it before.
You don't have to worry about it, Rocky.
I'm worried about it.
I'll have it for you by the end of the week.
You'll take me a few days to get settled. And by that time, you can get that dough together and tell me where I come in.
Where you come in? What do you mean?
Where I come in. What business you want me to handle, what parts of town, and what my cut is.
Your cut?
That was the idea, wasn't it? I took the rap the 3 years. You took the dough, made the connections, built it up for you and me. Wasn't that it?
Oh, I see, yes. I understand, but... Well, you got this thing all wrong. You see, I work for Kiefer. He's the boss. I haven't anything to say. If you want to find a spot in his business, why... You'll have to take it up with him.
Now, look, Frazier. I'm not taking it up with anybody but you. You figure it out for yourself.
Rocky, meanwhile, has reconnected with Jerry and is now living back in his old neighborhood where he befriends a gang of street urchins who idolize Rocky due to his criminal exploits. The story comes to a head when Jerry decides that the only way of preventing the boys from following Rocky's path in life is to rally public support and have Rocky and his gang arrested. Despite pressure from Frazier and his partner, Rocky refuses to have Jerry eliminated, which leads to a fatal shootout between the gang. Now on death row, Rocky declares that he'll go defiantly to the chair, unapologetic for his life of crime which delights the neighborhood gang. Seeing that Rocky will forever be a martyr in their eyes if this takes place, Jerry visits Rocky in prison to ask one last favor.
Just before I came up here, the boys saw me off on a train, Soapy and several of the others. Well, you can well imagine what they told me.
Should Father tell Rocky to show the world what he's made of? Tell him not to be afraid and go out laughing. And...
What do you want? I'm not going to let them down. That's what's worrying you.
That's what I want you to do. I want you to let them down. You see, you've been a hero to these kids and hundreds of others all through your life. And now you're going to be a glorified hero in death, and I want to prevent that, Rocky. They've got to despise your memory. They've got to be ashamed of you.
You asked me to pull an act, turn yellow, so those kids will think I'm no good. You asked me to throw away the only thing I got left, the only thing I've been able to take away from me. You want me to give those newspaper sophisters a chance to say another act turn yellow.
But, Rocky, you and I all know that you're not.
You're asking a nice little favor, Jerry. Ask me to crawl on my belly, last thing I do in life.
Rocky refuses and adamantly marches grimly to the chair. But as he's strapped in, he suddenly begins to beg for mercy. The switch is thrown, and Rocky dies as a tearful Jerry looks on, with the nation's newspapers declaring him to have died a coward's death. When the gang read all about it, their respect for him evaporates, and they are led away to bright futures by the guiding hand of Jerry. The film succeeds because it so cleverly subverts the usual crime drama stereotypes. Rocky's introduced as a stone-hearted man of violence, but we soon see that he's also intensely honorable and a loyal friend. The typical gangster movies of the 1930s unfailingly end with a violent shootout, but here, a more powerful climax takes place afterwards, with the extraordinary execution scene which elevates the movie from a simple crime thriller into something far more dramatic and emotional. Jerry's closing line harks back to the film's opening, reminding the viewer that Rocky was once a boy himself, who by a simple twist of fate, was forced along a corrosive path in life. The question of whether or not Rocky Sullivan does indeed choose to save the souls of the street gang has raged ever since. Does Rocky have a last-minute change of heart and grant Jerry his last request? Or are the tears of terror real? In looking at the film, said Jimmy later,
It's virtually impossible to say which course Rocky took, which is just the way I wanted it. I played the role with deliberate ambiguity so that the spectators can form their own opinions. It seems to me that it works out fine in either case. Roland Brown's script was eminently successful, but did allow for a little improvisation from the film's cast, especially in the case of Cagney, who imbued Rocky Sullivan with a few qualities from his childhood. Rocky's habit of hitching his trousers and twitching his neck, as well as his legendary catchphrase, came directly from a character that had fascinated Jimmy as a child, a local pimp who hung out on the corner of 78th Street and 1st Avenue. The pimp would take his place at the corner each morning, and due to his heavy drug use, would spend the entire day fidgeting nervously, hitching his trousers, rolling his neck, snapping his fingers and repeating the phrase, "What do you hear, what do you say?" whenever he caught a passerby's attention. "I did those gestures maybe 6 times in the picture," said Jimmy later. "That was over 30 years ago, and the Impressionists have been doing me doing him ever since." The chemistry between the two best friends in the film was made even more authentic by the casting of Pat O'Brien in the part of Jerry Connolly, perhaps Jimmy's closest friend. It also marked the first time that Jimmy starred opposite Humphrey Bogart, who starred here as the sniveling Jim Frazier. Bogart had so far carved himself out a niche as the main Warner Brothers rat, chalking up villainous roles in Three on a Match, The Petrified Forest, and Bullets or Ballads. Although one of the most well-respected and recognizable actors in the Warner stable at the time, his rise to the top would not begin in earnest until 1941, when a series of breakout roles in films such as The Maltese Falcon and High Sierra managed to free him from his stereotyping and transformed him into the iconic star we know today. Back in 1937, Bogart had been loaned out to Samuel Goldwyn for his production of Dead End, an adaptation of a highly successful Broadway hit by Sidney Kingsley, telling the tale of a squalid New York tenement building and its inhabitants. Bogart was given the role of the movie's villain here too, Babyface Martin, who's returned to the tenement to visit the mother who's ashamed of him. To play the part of the gang of street kids who form the basis for Dead End's main narrative, Goldwyn imported the 6 boys who'd played the gang on Broadway. Billy Hallop, Hunts Hall, Bobby Jordan, Leo Gorsi, Gabriel Dell and Bernard Pugsley. The boys, who were all actually aged between 18 and 22 at the time, arrived in Hollywood a little starstruck and began work on the film in good faith. But the differences between acting in a stage play and acting in a film soon became evident. Between takes, the boys were made to wait and wait, and growing increasingly bored, they began to funnel their energies into other areas. Tales began to filter back to Mr. Goldwyn of the horrors being committed against his studio by the boys and their hijinks. Property was destroyed. Walls were emblazoned with graffiti. A truck carrying props went missing and turned up half an hour later when it arrived bearing all 6 boys on a soundstage, where it promptly smashed its way through a wall and plowed into a set that had taken 3 months to construct. The boys took particular exception to Humphrey Bogart, who constantly groused at them for their behavior. One night, they ambushed him as he left the set, 4 of them holding him down, while the other 2 stole his trousers. For the next half hour, Bogart, in his underwear, chased the boys and his trousers, angrily cursing at them and demanding his cigarettes. When production on Dead End was finished, Goldwyn decided that the boys were far too much trouble and sold their 2-year contract to another studio. Unfortunately for Bogart, that studio was Warner Brothers, who immediately paired him with their new gang of juvenile actors, now known as the Dead End Kids. The film was Crime School, in which Bogart's state official investigates corruption at a notorious reformatory. The Dead End Kids played a rowdy gang who ally with Bogart to stamp out the corruption. Bogart was not happy at being starred alongside the rowdy gang and insisted that special Warner Brothers minders kept them away from him between takes. When the film was released, He was further dismayed to find that the dead-end kids had been given top billing in the film. He must have been even less delighted to discover that just a few months later, he was to be teamed with them again in Angels with Dirty Faces, in which they'd been cast as the rowdy street gang who idolized Rocky Sullivan. Jimmy's first meeting with the Dead End Kids was when they were all assembled to film the basketball game scene, in which the Dead End Kids roughhouse their way through a basketball match until Rocky uses their own tactics against them to make them play fair. By this time, the boys had become the scourge of the Warner studio, vandalizing property whenever the whim took them, and taking great delight in antagonizing their fellow Warner performers. Filming commenced, and immediately the boys began to act up, ad-libbing over other actors' lines, bursting into hysterics and making faces into the camera whenever it swung past them. After an hour of this, the frustration levels on set were growing, but no one wanted to confront the boys directly about their behavior. Those who'd done so in the past had faced stiff reprisals, including having their car tires let down and their dressing rooms vandalized. Jimmy arrived on set to film his parts and found Pat O'Brien and Ann Sheridan tense and angry. He took his mark and filming began. Almost immediately, Leo Gorsi from the Dead End Kids began to ad-lib. Each time that Jimmy spoke, Gorsi would shriek, "He's psychic! He's psychic!" Jimmy smiled, took his mark, and tried again. Gorsi again threw up his arms and began to shriek, but this time, instead of winning the laughter of his fellow gang and the disgruntled grumblings of the rest of the crew, he received a stinging blow on the nose from Jimmy's elbow, which snapped back and caught Gorsi so hard that he flew back against Hunt's Hall, knocking them both silly. As Gorsi staggered round, he was seized by the scruff of his neck by Jimmy, who poked a finger into his chest. "Come here, sucker," snapped Jimmy. "We've got work to do, and there'll be no more of this goddamn nonsense. We're going to do it the way you've been told to do it, understand?" Gorsi mumbled his apology and promised to behave. Jimmy glared around at the other five boys, who all apologized and promised to behave themselves. The rest of the shoot passed by in harmony. As Doug Warren later wrote in his biography of James Cagney, "Bogart may have looked tough and acted tough, but Cagney was tough." There was no further trouble with them on set. Angels with Dirty Faces was instantly acclaimed as a classic, raking in a colossal fortune at the box office and pulling in some of the best notices that the Warner Studios had ever had. Jimmy received his first Academy Award nomination for Best Actor for his portrayal of Rocky Sullivan, beaten out narrowly by his close friend Spencer Tracy for Boys Town. By the end of the year, the film had been confirmed as the 9th highest grossing film of 1938. And the $234,000 that Jimmy had drawn in earnings from Warner Brothers had seen him become their highest paid star. The James Cagney Renaissance had well and truly begun. The news came on a crisp December afternoon at Jack Warner's golf club. Mid-Decembers in California were generally impervious to snowfall, which suited the Hollywood golf player down to a tee. Jack Warner himself was readying his first shot on a favorite par 3, while the rest of his group, consisting of Al Jolson, Harpo Marx, and Louis B. Mayer, were chatting idly a few feet behind him. As Jack's shot connected, sending his ball flying with purpose towards the green, two men burst from the clubhouse doors and began to scream. "It's coming in over the radio," they called. "They've just bombed Pearl Harbor." Marx, Jolson, and Mayer each looked at each other, aghast, and began to hurry towards the clubhouse, leaving Jack still balancing on his toes. His club swung back behind him, his eye trained on the ball which landed at the fringe of the green. It hopped twice, grazed the green surface, and disappeared into the hole with a distant clank. "I sank it," he cried, then turned to find that he was alone. "Hole in one. Greatest shot I've made all year. And no one's going to believe me."
He shoved his club back into his bag and began to stamp towards the clubhouse. Where in the hell is Pearl Harbor, anyway?
Important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
This is John Daly speaking from the CBS newsroom in New York. Here is the Far East situation as reported to this moment. The Japanese have attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and our defense facilities at Manila, capital of the
Philippines. This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu.
The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaii.
Go ahead, Honolulu. We should like to now try to call in Manila, the capital of the Philippine Commonwealth. Go ahead, Manila.
Short while later, he dictated another message. A second air attack has been reported. This one has been made on the Army and Navy bases in Manila. And here's a last-minute Associated Press flash from Honolulu. A naval engagement is in progress off Honolulu with at least one black enemy aircraft carrier in action against the Pearl Harbor defenses. In view of Prime Minister Churchill's recent pledge that a British declaration of war on Japan would follow almost immediately upon the outbreak of war between Japan and the United States, a British announcement is expected soon.
As soon as I heard last night that Japan had attacked the United States, my first feeling was that Parliament should be immediately summoned. You will remember that a month ago, with the full approval of the nation and of the Empire, I pledged the word of Great Britain that should the United States become involved in a war with Japan, a British declaration would follow within the hour. The cabinet, therefore, which met at 12:30 today, authorized an immediate declaration of war upon Japan.
This is CBS in America calling Manila. Go ahead. We regret that we are unable to contact either Honolulu or Manila. We return you now to William L. Shirer in New York.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives. Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Place.
From high to low, America and her Americans were gripped by war fever. Lines began to form at enlistment offices, and a few months later, American bankers, butchers, messengers, bellhops, postmen, singers, teachers, dentists, architects, gardeners, and hairdressers had become soldiers, joining the emigrant masses of every other profession in the fight against the Axis wolves in foreign lands. In Hollywood, an exodus of sorts had begun. Studio bosses watched as their biggest stars began to drift away, eager to join the fight in any way possible, be it on promotional tours to sell war bonds, or on planes alongside their fellow soldiers to Europe. In response, a state of austerity was declared throughout Hollywood, a time for efficiency and careful planning. Money could not be spent frivolously on overblown entertainments for audiences who were no longer there. Chances could not be taken. Productions were scaled back. But at Warner Brothers, a rather different plan was in mind. Our company is about to start the largest program of pictures for the government that has ever been undertaken to be made by any company in the industry, Harry announced. We have agreed to make from 400 to 500 reels of training pictures in the coming year. We are also going to make Irving Berlin's This Is the Army. In making these pictures, we want them made at absolute cost. When I say absolute cost, I mean exactly that. I don't want to make a single dollar of profit out of these pictures. Under Harry's orders, each studio employee was firmly asked to visit the Red Cross trucks that arrived at the Warner Studios and give their blood to the war effort. By the time of the war's end, over 763 employees had been drained of 5,200 pints of plasma, several dozen of which had belonged to Harry Warner himself. At each Warner premiere, war bonds were aggressively sold to the black tie crowds. Warner contract players were put on trains alongside their rival studio counterparts to fly the flag for the boys in Europe, to remind housewives and those deemed unfit for service that they were all in this together. If a studio employee expressed his desire to join the fight, then he would receive all the help possible by Harry, even down to ticket fares and traveling expenses. Within a year of war being declared, a quarter of the Warner employees were part of the US military. Jack Warner Jr. had been one of the first to enlist. After college, he'd been recruited by the United States Marine Corps and had spent 2 years in training, finally attaining the rank of second lieutenant in the reserves unit. The commissioning ceremony took place at the LA Coliseum, and still clinging to some vestige of family loyalty, Jack Jr. sent out invitations to the two households of his parents. The first, to his mother Irma and her new husband-to-be, film director Al Rogel, was eagerly accepted. The second was sent to his father and his wife Anne, and several weeks after sending it, Jack Jr. had not received a reply. On the day of the ceremony, he arrived to the organized chaos of proud parents and uniformed youth, and checked with an attendant that the two pairs of seats he'd reserved had been placed as far away from each other as possible. His mother and Al Rogel arrived almost an hour before the ceremony started, his mother fussing around him with nervous, wide eyes, while Rogel simply hung back and smiled warmly. This moment did not belong to a newcomer to the family, and he knew it. "I am so proud of you," she told him again and again, instinctively reaching up to touch him from time to time. A hand on the arm, a hand on the cheek. "I'm sorry for the past few years," she said. "God knows, I didn't want us to arrive at this point as broken as we are." "Not broken," he said. "Weathered, maybe." He showed his mother and Al Rogel to their seats, and joined his fellow trainees as the ceremony began. As his turn came to be called to the stage, he rose and glanced down at his mother, gripping Al's arm and staring at him with dizzy pride. As he made his way towards the stage, he looked to the opposite bank of seats, where a few minutes before, two seats in the center row had been noticeably vacant. They were now both occupied. The first contained the beaming, overly tanned face of his father, who waved once and put up his thumb. Next to him was the heavy-set face of Abdul Maljan, his father's masseur. Jack Jr. joined the many thousands of reserves across America and patiently waited for his turn to be called into action. Over the course of the next few years, he returned to an apprenticeship at Warner Brothers, flying all over the country in the role of emissary, spending time in all corners of the Warner Empire, except the one in Hollywood. First, my father suggested I go to the Home Office in New York, as it was time to learn all I could about distribution and exhibition of film, said Jack Jr. During the next couple of years, I visited nearly every film exchange and Warner Circuit Theater in the United States and Canada. Later on, I figured my father had done me a good turn, sort of by accident, as his real objective was not my education, but getting me physically far away. The closer I was, the more I reminded him of things he preferred to forget. On the day that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, Jack Jr. drove to his father's home on Angelo Drive and presented himself at the door. Jack emerged from his study to greet his son, his face a blend of surprised joy and stormy doubt. As his heels clicked against the parquet floor, he glanced at the darkened landing that ran around the upper echelons of the lobby. "Jackie," he said, shaking his son's hand. "This is a nice surprise." And then, in a low, cautionary voice, "You really should call before you decide to come over here, though." Jack Jr. looked up at the landing, and then back at his father. "Dad, I need to talk to you."
"Okay, what's up?"
"In private," Jack Jr. said. Can we go somewhere?" The door above them clicked, and they both looked up to see a slim, dark figure, silhouetted in a bedroom doorway.
"Anne," said Jack, "Jackie just came around to see me. To see us. Isn't that nice?"
The frozen figure of Anne Warner regarded them both for a moment, and then closed the door. Jack Jr. and his father spent the next 2 hours walking slowly around the Warner grounds as a purple California winter evening fell around them. Jack seemed unusually pleased to talk, frantically so, as though he'd been starved of human companionship for some time. Jack Jr. listened as his father described the Warner Studios production slate, their expansion plans, a few land purchases, the cars he'd been looking at lately. Whenever a silence fell, Jack would sigh for long moments and grunt at the passing lawns, or kick a pebble and say, "California winters, huh?" Eventually, the man and his son arrived at the swimming pool and regarded each other in the water's reflection, beyond which, past the whipped, flickering surface of the water, lay the brown, tiled octopus at the bottom of the pool. "You know," said Jack Jr., "my favorite place to dive from was always the sand rock." He motioned to a golden oval brick that jutted from the neat rockery near the water's edge. "My toes always seemed to curl around the rock as I jumped. I could jump like a frog from that thing."
"Barbara doesn't swim much," Jack said, scratching his head.
"Anne's filled her head with stories about how the water babies never get to heaven. Dad, I'm going to war." Jack looked at his boy.
"When?"
"It'll be a few weeks. They're sending me to Camp Robinson in Arkansas. From there," he shrugged. Jack nodded and tried to smile, but for the first time in his life, his eyes failed to disguise the pain. "Gonna miss you, boy."
"I'll see to it that Edgar's trained up to take my place in the office," said Jack Jr.
"No one's taking your place," said Jack. Your chair stays empty till you get back. It'll always be that way. Jack held out his hand, and Jack Jr. took it. Will you come to the train to see me off? Said Jack Jr. Do you want me to? Very much. Jack smiled. I'd be honored. Jackie, I'm very proud of you. I wish you all the luck in the world, and I want you to promise to take care of yourself and bring yourself home. Jack Jr. glanced up at the curtained window on the second floor of the house and wondered exactly how he was supposed to define the word home these days. 3 weeks later, on the night before he left for Camp Robinson, he arrived in his uniform to say farewell to his co-workers at the Biltmore Bowl in Los Angeles, where the Studio Employees Club held its annual dinner dance. Jack Jr. wandered from handshake to handshake, sipping on a martini and drifting in and out of dances with up-and-coming starlets and nervous-looking secretaries. At around 10 p.m., heads turned towards the bowl's entrance, and Jack Jr. looked to see his father tenderly escorting a resplendent Anne down the stairs by the fingertips. A smattering of applause rippled through the room, to which Jack replied with a smile and a wave. Jack Jr. eased himself through the partygoers and applauded with them as he met his father at the bottom of the steps. Dad, Anne, he said, smiling. I think I speak for all of us here.
You,
spat Anne, glaring at Jack Jr. with black, venomous hatred.
You stay away from my house. Stay away from my husband. Stay away from me.
The hissed insult rang for long seconds around the silent hall as eyes fell downwards, as cheeks flushed red with embarrassment. Jack Jr. looked to his father in shock and found a father who could not meet his son's eye. Violently, Anne wrenched her hand free of her husband's and stamped loudly into the crowd to find a drink. I began Jack. I just... Dad, said Jack Jr. But before he could say any more, Jack had fled into the safety of the party, which had begun to slowly fizz back into life. I felt deeply sorry for my father, Jack Jr. said later, but I did not know what I could possibly say. I didn't see them again that evening, and when the train left the next morning for Arkansas, he was not there to say goodbye. The icy exterior of Anne Warner had been given a fresh coat of frost by her run-in with Jack just a few days before. Jack Warner's extramarital affairs were as much a part of the Hollywood story as Leo the Lion and The Sign on the Hills. His unfaithfulness had ironically led to his current marriage to Anne herself. But although he remained incapable of monogamy, it was demanded absolutely of his wife. Therefore, to find out that Anne had enjoyed a private life equally as active and sometimes in excess of his own had come as a bitter blow. Most of these boys were simply brief adventures or flirtations that climaxed in short, sharp physical acts. Anne Warner knew that her future was with Jack, and as a result, no promises were made to these honeybees. However, during 1940, things had gotten a little too serious with an employee, the actor Eddie Albert, who'd been under contract to Warner Brothers since 1936. A man that Anne just couldn't seem to cross out of her social diary. At least once a week, she would evade the house under the pretense of a shopping trip and meet with Albert at a roadside motel or at one of the more private stretches of beach that fringed the California coast. And then one day, Albert did not answer her calls, and when Anne personally visited his apartment after days of fretting, she found that he had abruptly left, leaving behind rumors of a fresh start in Mexico. For months, she'd assumed that the pain of saying goodbye to her had been too difficult to face, But the disappearance of Albert had also coincided with a brightening in the mood of her husband, and it wasn't long before she began to realize that Jack may have had something to do with the end of her clandestine relationship. It was a week or so before the Biltmore Bowl party, when news began to reach Hollywood that Eddie Albert had indeed relocated to Mexico, where he joined a friend's circus. Word had been sent now, though, that just a month or so ago, he'd returned to the US to enlist in the Navy, and was now somewhere in the fight on the high seas. When Anne had mentioned the news to Jack over dinner that evening in an attempt to draw out the poison, his vanity had compelled him to tell her the truth. Eddie Albert had been easy to get rid of. Jack had personally assured Albert that he was no longer required for movie work at the studio, despite having been one of their rising stars. A few phone calls later, and the door of every studio in town was being slammed in his face. The Warner-owned apartment in which he lived was suddenly repossessed by stern-faced ogres of men who hinted at further violence if he didn't scram soon. Yes, Eddie Albert had been easy to get rid of. The others would be too. Jack raised his wine glass and grinned. To us, my love. In 1942, Jack Warner reported to the office of General Henry Arnold in Washington. Arnold was among the most decorated of officers in the United States. At the time, he held the rank of General of the Army and General of the Air Force, and had summoned Jack to Washington with a special purpose in mind. "Jack, you're a great filmmaker," Arnold told him. "We need men like you in this fight. How would you like to make some special training films for my new Air Force Signal Corps unit?" "Sure," Jack replied. "On one condition." Arnold frowned. "And what would that be?" Jack pointed to the stars on Arnold's shoulder. "Daryl Zanuck's been made a colonel in the army. I want to be a general." Arnold laughed and said he'd see what he could do. A few days after arriving back in Hollywood, he received an official communication from Arnold's office, bestowing upon him the rank of lieutenant colonel. The first man to receive Jack's news was Milton Sperling, who'd arrived on business. "Hey, Sperling," barked Jack. "What's higher, colonel or lieutenant colonel?" "Lieutenant colonel's one rank lower than colonel," replied Sperling. "Are you sure?" "Yeah, pretty sure." "God damn it," snapped Jack. "Oh, well, I guess I can always rise up. Advance, what do you call it? You mean like get a promotion?" "Yeah, sure. Now let's see about a damn uniform." Jack swept to the Warner Wardrobe Department and commanded that all available personnel attend to the making of a new military uniform for him. Within a few hours, he'd emerged into the California sunshine, dressed head to toe in the uniform of a lieutenant colonel, and proceeded to saunter through the studio backlot, playfully saluting everyone he passed. As he rounded the corner to his office, he was suddenly met by two newly commissioned second lieutenants, who upon seeing the stars on his shoulder, immediately jumped to attention and raised their hands in a rigid salute. Jack frowned goofily at them, blissfully unaware of the correct procedure, and smacked them both on the arm. "Hiya, boys. Relax or something. Go back to your business and stuff." Jack's exhilarated jubilation was suddenly cut short the following week when he received another official letter from the office of General Arnold. Upon reading it, he picked up the phone and commanded Milton Sperling to come to his house immediately. Sperling arrived to find Anne Warner collapsed in grief on the sofa in their lounge, while Jack paced nervously back and forth, sucking desperately on a cigarette. When Anne saw Sperling enter, she looked up and wailed, "He'll be killed!" "What's going on, Jack?" Sperling asked. Jack stamped across the room and shoved the letter in Sperling's face. "This is the goddamn matter," he cried. "They're sending me to a fucking training camp. A fucking training camp in Missouri." Sperling took the letter and read it carefully, trying his best not to burst into laughter as Anne wailed to his left. "You are to report on the following date," read Sperling. "You don't need to read it," said Jack. "Sperling, are you laughing?" "No,
No, Jack, not at all. So what the hell do I do? How do I get out of this? Well, Jack, I mean, you're a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army now. Maybe you should go.
Yes, but I'm not a real colonel. Hell, I've only been a colonel for 5 fucking minutes.
Sperling shrugged. Maybe you'll enjoy camp.
Why in the hell do they want me to go there?
Said Jack. Listen, Jack, when you put that uniform on, you made an obligation.
Hap Arnold never mentioned a word about this, said Jack, sucking on his cigarette.
Resign your commission then, shrugged Sperling.
You're overage anyway. You don't have to go to war. Just take off the uniform and resign.
Jack frowned and looked down at his crisp uniform, fiddling proudly with the buttons.
Well, he said. Well, geez. What would it look like if I resigned my commission already? I've only been a colonel for about 10 minutes.
You mean 5 minutes, said Sperling.
Exactly.
I'll tell you what, said Sperling. Get on the phone to General Arnold and find out what is going on. My guess is that he probably doesn't know this has happened. Someone in an office probably just punched a button and your name came out next to Camp Missouri.
Jack considered for a moment.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. You're probably right. I'll call old Hap and find out who screwed this whole thing up.
A few moments later, Jack had been connected to General Arnold, and when he told him about the letter, even Anne and Milton Sperling on the other side of the room could hear the raucous, bellowing laughter coming from the earpiece of the phone.
Why are you laughing? Said Jack. This is serious, Hap. I'm not going to a fucking camp in Missouri to learn how to march in a fucking line.
Hell, I would love to see you in a camp, said Arnold. But you better not go, Jack. It would demoralize the whole damn army. Tell you what, you go to Washington from time to time and report back to me on the best place to pick up broads.
But the war for Harry Warner was a markedly different experience. He was not concerned with, or promised, decorative baubles in return for the use of the Warner propaganda machine. He was interested only in using the empire that he'd built to attack the empire that Hitler had built, and he was steadfastly promised to the cause, even if it cost him his last dollar. Hollywood was changing, and Harry Warner could see it. The old frivolous Hollywood passing before his eyes like leaves on the water, replaced by a more responsible industry who could use the mighty tool that they'd created to inspire, to educate, and to illuminate. The glamour era has vanished, he said at the time. Glamour belonged to a decade which brought us this war. The days of swimming pools and fast cars and bathing-suited cuties chasing rich young men into honorable marriage have been wrenched away from us, and I, for one, am grateful for it. The cuties are in overalls these days, standing over airplane parts or welding and riveting. Or they are living quietly in a small room existing on a soldier's pay and thinking night and day in terms of how to win and win quickly. Another decade of glamour and frolic may come back to us, and if it does, I hope this monstrous war will have taught man to leaven his fun with some thought. Each day, Harry received fresh news from the hidden Europe under Nazi control. From deep-rooted correspondents and family members still stranded in their homelands, desperately trying to survive the conflict. From Poland, tales of German soldiers shooting dead women with prams for sport. Of the parades of grandmothers marched to the woods to face grinning teenage firing squads. Mile-long lines of men made to lie packed in pits, heaped upon each other, and then sprayed with gunfire, and in many cases, buried alive by bulldozers. The war for Harry Warner had become a series of ever-escalating examples of the erosion of basic human decency, and as each day passed, a little more of the color in his world began to fade. Under his orders, Warner Studios began to turn out a series of short films designed to educate the public about the task ahead. Titles such as March On, Marines, The Tanks Are Coming, Here Comes the Cavalry, and Meet the Fleet were initially met with enthusiasm, and then, as months passed, with a dawning fatigue.
It was Jack who recognized that even films with a message needed to be balanced with entertainment. "For Christ's sake, Harry," said Jack. "We're trying to offer relief to Americans, not make them jump off a roof."
"Jack, we have a responsibility."
"And don't think that fast cars and cuties comment passed me by either."
"Jack, do you realize the importance of our duty?"
"Of course I realize it, but we're Hollywood. We're creators. We sell dreams and ideas in brightly colored boxes. Pills are always easier to swallow when they're coated in honey. You just keep making the boring speeches and leave the movie making to me." For the first time in forever, it was Harry's turn to slam down the phone in anger. But Jack Warner had a point. The public were far more likely to open their minds to pro-American messages if they were set to the soundtrack of a sweeping orchestra. 1941's Sergeant York saw Gary Cooper portray real-life World War I veteran Alvin York, a man who single-handedly captured 132 German soldiers in the Argonne. Its blend of action, wit, and deep-rooted patriotism was lapped up by America and finished as the year's highest-earning film at the box office. Casablanca from the following year preached a vehemently anti-Nazi message, but did so against the backdrop of Moroccan intrigue and the glamour of Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman's selfless love affair. But perhaps the most bombastic Warner display of American pride came in the spring of 1942, when another chance came around for James Cagney to put on his dancing shoes. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to continue this epic story immediately, then go on over now to patreon.com/attaboysecret or follow the link in the show notes of this episode. Hear every thrill, every drama, every heartbreak, every spellbinding moment. Unlock the secret history of Hollywood now at patreon.com/attaboysecret. Or follow the link in the show notes of this episode. And thank you.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.